You're listening to a Weeby Geeks Network podcast.
It's Pro Wrestling Cast.
Shut up! My time has come, and that's the bottom line.
With your hosts, Al John and Steven.
I've been the best ever since day one when I walked into this company.
It's Pro Wrestling Cast, for a weekly look into the world of professional wrestling.
I'm going to reach out right now. I want you at home to know my hand is touching your hand.
Follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Cast and on Twitter at P Wrestling Cast.
I always try to do what's best for business.
Have a question or just want to comment? Leave us a voicemail at 615-9339-PWC. That's 615-9339-792.
Or how about a Y2J telling you to shut the hell up?
And now, Pro Wrestling Cast.
Hulk Hogan, we got it for you.
Welcome to yet another edition of Pro Wrestling Cast, your weekly webcast and podcast for wrestling fans. For Marks by Marks, right? And I am Al John Goh, your host and lifelong wrestling fan, professional broadcaster, having fun here, podcasting with my good friend, the heel commentator, the wrestling historian, Mr. Stephen Anthony. How are you, sir?
WCW fan for life.
Exactly right. On tonight's show, we have a very special guest or two joining us, and we are going to be talking about WCW. We're going to touch on Halloween Havoc, as we promised. Mr. Scott Hudson, legendary broadcaster, the sound, the voice of thunder, joining us, and that Nashville pro wrestling guy, a promoter and a writer for TNA Online, a former writer for TNA Online, Scott Barry, close personal friend of mine. I haven't talked to him in many years, but we reconnected and got guys from the wrestling business talking about this business of professional wrestling, which we do have a passion for. We just conducted the interview, and I have to say, what gentlemen. It's always good to my friend Scott Barry to talk to him. It's been a while, but Scott Hudson, legendary broadcaster, and his comments were very eye-opening, ear-opening, if you will, if you're listening to this on demand. Stephen, what are your thoughts on the interview real quick?
I was stunned by how, first of all, Scott Hudson is a class act. That's the first thing I have to say. This guy is a gentleman in the old school way. He is the real thing. He's how people should act these days, okay, in this age of being whatever. Second of all, the things he talked about, his insight into WCW, GFW, the now defunct GFW, you know, a little bit into TNA too, but especially talking about the Tacoma Raw and talking about his dealings with Eric Bischoff, commentators like Tony Schiavone, who he spoke very highly of, and Jeff Jarrett. It was really quite interesting. It was especially interesting to get his opinions on some of the wrestlers like Ric Flair and also some of the more controversial figures like Vince Russo. But here is a guy that has been in WCW when they were making money hand over fist. And here is a guy that was in the most legendary moment, perhaps, of Raw WCW history, the Tacoma Raw. So he really has dealt with every entity when wrestling was at its absolute zenith. So he's a very interesting figure. He's very informative. He was very well spoken, and I was completely impressed with him in every way.
And one of the people involved in the infamous and now historic, and I dare say, most iconic moments in my mind of any moment in pro wrestling history, the simulcast between WWE, Raw, and Nitro. And that to me will always be the most surreal and memorable moment for me in my wrestling fandom, because it was something I never thought I would ever see, and we will never see the likes of again. And Scott gives us some great insight into those moments and those figures in moments of time. And Steven, did something you wanted to say?
I just wanted to say how historic that, I mean, that was such a historic moment. It goes back decades and decades. Toots Mon, Vince McMahon Sr., the Crockett, Jim Crockett Sr., and everything, and all culminating in this one moment where the son, Vince McMahon Jr., owns the Crocketts, owns the NWA in a weird, strange way and ends the war once and for all. Not so much the Monday Night War, the territorial warfare that he had started probably against his father's wishes. It's an incredible moment. And Scott Hudson was there talking to Gerald Briscoe, talking to Shane McMahon, watching it unfold, being involved in the initial episodes of Raw where they tried to, you know, have a WCW show as well. Incredibly interesting human being.
Absolutely. So we're going to get into the meat potatoes over the next hour plus talking about it. But let's not forget, this show is free, and it's because we have support from people like you. Visiting and subscribing to our show via iTunes, on Stitcher, as well as on YouTube. Make sure you like and subscribe to the show and tell all your friends over social media, where you can follow us at Pro Wrestling Cast, at P Wrestling Cast Twitter, Pro Wrestling Cast on Facebook, and of course, our archive of shows at ProWrestling.com and our YouTube page. Support the show. We've got Amazon links. You can click on those banners specifically at ProWrestlingCast.com. Support the show. You can also click the links for HighSpots.com, as we are fond of promoting shoot videos and interviews. If you can't get enough pro wrestling interviews, that is a great resource for you. And last but not least, we're also affiliates of WWE Shop and WWE Network. If you have not subscribed to the WWE Network, click on our links and every bit will help us out. You sign up and you visit our shop, you visit our website, you click and you sign up, and we get credit for that. It doesn't cost you any more, just like Amazon, just like HighSpots, but it does help our show out because we do this for free. And once again, your catch-all for all things Pro Wrestling Cast at ProWrestlingCast.com. So without any further ado, let's go ahead and launch into our interview with Mr. Scott Barry and Scott Hudson, legendary announcer for WCW, right here on Pro Wrestling Cast. We are leading up to Halloween. We're going to be talking about WCW Halloween Havoc. And to help us talk about some of the trials and tribulations, the things that he's experienced, we've got several different guests. First off, my old friend, Mr. Scott Barry. He used to work for Nashville Pro Wrestling. What's going on, Mr. Scott Barry? How are you? There are two Scotts on the show, so I have to say Mr. Scott Barry.
Oh, doing good. It's been a long time, Al John, and glad to help you out with this, and it's going to be fun.
And also joining us on the phone, we have our co-host, Mr. Stephen Anthony, the man with the glove of injustice, the heel commentator, the wrestling historian. Mr. Stephen Anthony, how are you doing, sir?
How's it going, my friend? I thought at the beginning when you did the introduction, you said we're gearing up for Halloween Havoc this month. I swear you were going to say that.
It is. Yeah, we're gearing up for Halloween Havoc this month.
Should I put on my cheesy vampire outfit for this? Or
you could if you wanted to. You definitely could. And, you know, Vampiro might have some gimmick infringement issues with that. But, you know, he's over at the Underground. Yeah, your old Eric Bischoff outfit. Nice. Okay. Well, speaking of Halloween Havoc, speaking of Eric Bischoff, a gentleman who is known as the voice of WCW Thunder, commentator extraordinaire, WCW legend, Mr. Scott Hudson. How are you, sir?
Fantastic, guys. Thanks for having me. And I was hoping you were going to break the news there would be a Halloween Havoc this year. That's where I thought you were going too, Al John, but exactly. Alas, no more Halloween Havoc. That would be great if they did it, though.
Exactly. We'd be doing the Halloween Havoc and continuing on with the earlier Halloween Havoc tradition, maybe not so much of the latter, but some of the earlier tradition of Halloween Havoc, and talk a little bit about some of our most infamous and famous and favorite moments from that pay-per-view coming up a little bit in the program. But let's first talk to the Scott Squared. We've got Scott Barry, Scott Hudson. Scott Barry, I've known you for many years, great fan of music. You and I have done a lot of shows and things together with my old rock band when we were touring, but you were involved in wrestling promotion here in Music City. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I just kind of tripped into it by accident. I'd been working in the business for, 11 or 12 years or so. And a new group came to me. They'd never even really been in the business before. They were still doing research and reached out to me to answer some questions and give them some advice. And the next thing I knew, I was a partner in the promotion. And the guys behind it, it was Nashville Pro Wrestling is the group. They're still kind of around. We run two shows, and then we run out of money. And as anybody who's promoted an independent wrestling show will know, it costs you well more than you will make. It is a practice of passion, not of money.
Oh, yeah, just ask Reno Riggins and all them about that.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Tony Falk, Bart Prentice.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, and that's how I mean, and it's so funny. it's funny because when I was doing voiceover work for the local promotion here, I'd totally forgotten that you'd done stuff, you know, with those other cats as well, working with Reno Riggins. That's what I was doing. But, you know, all of a sudden, we're doing this podcast. I find you, and then you said, hey, by the way, I know Mr. Scott Hudson. And, Scott, how did you get to know Scott Barry?
When I was...
He got suckered into
between gigs, as it were, when WCW had went under, and before TNA had started, I was working for Bert Prentice with USA Championship Wrestling just to you know, scratch that itch of being involved in the wrestling business, and that sort of led indirectly to hanging out with Tony Falk at his USWO group there in Madison, Tennessee, and when I would work there, I met Scott there, who was, were you a manager, I think? Or you were already a commentator?
When we first met, I was still in the crowd. I was a fan.
Oh, and fair enough. Yeah, but that was it. And so it was just trying to bridge the gap between WCW and whatever came next. And I met Scott up at the USWO shows. That was Tony Falk's group, indie group in Nashville. And that was it. I mean, Scott's a good guy, good talent. Very great talent, actually, and so we just hit it off and have stayed friends. Gosh, it's been, yikes, that's like 2002, so 13 years.
14 years, yeah, your check's in the mail.
Yeah, Tony mailed that to you for sure. The state of professional wrestling has changed so much since the time of WCW. Mr. Hudson, how did you get involved with pro wrestling and commentating to begin with?
I'll try to make this as quick as possible. I am old, Al, John, and Steven. I am 51 years old.
What? That's not old.
That's not old.
Well, it's older than I was. and when I was 5 years old in 1970, I was lucky enough that my grandfather, Bill Hudson, who lived down in Cuthbert, Georgia, we would go visit him, my folks and I would go see him, and he was a huge mark for wrestling. Mm. And when we would go see him on those long weekends down in Cuthbert, he would say, Scotty, come on back here with me, let's watch some wrestling. Yes, sir. And so I'd go back there into their bedroom. They had a couple of lounge chairs in their bedroom and a TV, and we would watch WRBL out of Columbus with the Columbus, Georgia version of Georgia Championship Wrestling. They had their own TV show. Back in the territory days, each promoter would be given his own television show. There wasn't like one show that would be syndicated. Each promoter had his own TV. And so I would watch that, and my grandfather, who I adored, would just like wrench the arms of his Barca Lounger right out of their hinges, you know, worry about Danny Little Bear and Bob Armstrong and Big Bill Drummo and El Mongo and all those guys. And I got to be a mark, and that never changed up until right now here at the end of 2015. I'm still a mark, and as it were, I've parlayed that into becoming a huge fan, and also as just by pure dumb luck, I became a disc jockey when I was in high school still, just to find a part-time job. I didn't want to go out and do real work out on the cotton field that I had done for several years, so I became a disc jockey. And, you know, did okay at that, and the general manager said, didn't you play ball? I said, yeah, I played high school ball. He goes, well, how about you become the play-by-play guy for our high school football team? I said, sure. So that was it. And when I became a play-by-play announcer for high school and then college football, I parlayed my love of wrestling and being able to do, after 7 or 8 years, you know, beginning in 1983, of doing high school and college football and then basketball and baseball. And I moved to Atlanta, and here's the story. I met up with my best friend in the world, Stephen Prazak, and we went to an independent show out in Carrollton, Georgia, and the ring announcer was horrible. I mean, he was calling, like, girls by guys' names and mask guys by, like, unmasked names. He was terrible. And I went up to the promoter, a guy named Joe Pedicino, whom I'd never met. And I said, I don't know what you're paying this stiff, but I'll do it for nothing. And he said, you're hired. And that was it. The next show, I was the ring announcer. And it went off without a hitch. And he said, you've done this before. I said, I've actually done radio for 9 years, and I've done, pretty big deal high school and college. He goes, I got an idea. How about you grab your friend, Stephen Prazak, and you guys create a point-counterpoint. You be the baby face, he'll be the heel, and you guys argue about stuff, and we'll put it on our TV show in Atlanta. So I went from sitting in the front row to being on TV in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And Steve did the same thing. And from there, about a month later, we were doing the commentary for Joe's indie group, North Georgia, Georgia All-Star Wrestling, back in 1990. And from there, it took off. So it was just, being at the right place at the right time and working my ass off, learning how to do play-by-play at college and high school athletics, and being a mark, which is always the best, the best line item on any announcer's resume.
Oh, yeah.
Which also means that Michael Cole sucks as an announcer because he's not a mark. He's an idiot.
Oh, no.
That was really exciting.
Wow.
Hang on.
Let me rephrase. He's a mark for himself.
Oh, okay.
The business. There you go.
Well put. I didn't want to stray from that incredible comment too much, but you mentioned Joe Pedicino. I was wondering, could you talk a little bit about GWF and the global wrestling thing that happened in the early 90s? That seemed like such an interesting federation that didn't really get to blossom like it could have, but it had so many great workers.
Here's the story. And Scott knows this. He knows everything about me, so he knows this story. As a real job, I work as a Fed. I've been to college for 1,000 years. I got every advanced degree in the world, and I'm a Fed in the criminal justice system. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
And we have had several prosecutions of what we now refer to our West African Task Force, which is fraud based out of the West Coast of Africa. And that's where you get into a lot of identity theft and all this other stuff, and including one scam that still makes its way around, and that's the lost Nigerian prince.
Yes.
Or someone will get an email and say, hey, right, I'm the son of the king. If you'll send me your routing information for your checking account, I need to hide $40 million in your checking account, and I'll let you keep $2 million if you'll just send me the stuff. And they'll troll that out to, 600,000 people, and three or four will fall for it, and that's all they need, and they'll clean them out. Well, Joe got the same kind of thing, Joe Pedicino, and to his everlasting credit, almost fell for it. Didn't give him routing information, but sort of struck up a friendship. Hey, you're a rich guy. How about help me start this new wrestling group? Well, he had this guy named Oluwoliami back in 1991. That was the guy. That was the, let's just say, in my opinion, borderline dishonest investor in the Global Wrestling Federation. Well, when it came time to write the check, he wrote the check, and it was no good. So then Joe had to go scrounge up other investors, and then he did, but had to start off global with a great deal less money than he thought. If you go back and look and this is how I got my start, guys, in at the Wrestling Observer, at the Pro Wrestling Torch, and Arena Reports, and Mat Watch, writing for the sheets back in the 80s. That's where I learned the business and cut my teeth and how the inner workings of the business worked. You go back and look at those reports back then, Joe supposedly had $25 million from an African investor to start the group. Well, wow. That was a scam. And he never got scammed. He never lost any money, but by the time he had figured it out, he had already decided he wanted to go for it, and so put together real investors, and off we go with Global. And I was already, Steve Prazak and I were already doing the Georgia All-Star Wrestling. And right. Again, this is how crazy and stupid life can be. I went from, the front row in Carrollton to doing the thing with Prazak on the Saturday Night Wrestling block 2 weeks later to hosting the show, hosting the Georgia Indie show 2 weeks after that, to being on ESPN 2 months after that.
Wow,
and that's insane. But that's what happened to me. It sounds like a letter to Penthouse. But I swear to God, that's what happened.
The fast track for Ernest Hudson.
Unbelievable.
Wow, that is crazy, man. Now I know that you spent a great amount of your career at WCW. Did Eric Bischoff find you? Did somebody in the office find you as a talent to recruit you for WCW? How did that come about?
Well, when Global came and went in the early 90s, It went under after a while, but before it went completely under, it was dying on the vine because the money ran out. Right. You know, that $25 million that scam artist Oliami would have put in would have helped, but as it was, they didn't have nearly that deep a pocket. So eventually the first thing that got cut was travel. Well, Global, if you go back and watch those shows, it was me, Joe, Bonnie, Prazak, Mark Bagwell, Scott Levy, you know, Raven, Scott Anthony, Del Wilkes, The Patriot, Cactus, a lot of guys coming in from Minneapolis and from the Southeast, all going to Dallas through the TV. So when the budget went south and travel got cut, that promotion almost overnight became a Dallas-based promotion. And all of us were gone because they couldn't, you know, we weren't going to fly us out anymore. So it then became, you know, Stephen Dane and Gary Young and basically a rehash of the USWA. And no offense to those guys who were wonderful talents and good guys, but it wasn't going to make it. So that's what happened with, you know, when Global went under. Then, but we never stopped doing the Georgia show, Steve Prazak and I. We continued to do it until 1995, and then it went under. And, you know, that's the breaks. Wrestling is, you know, begins to fail. That's all it does. So that's it. And like I told you before, I am a proud public servant of all of you guys. I work for the federal government. I bust my ass, and I swear to God, you get your money's worth out of me every day, including tomorrow. But this would have been 1995. I had been with the feds for a little bit, and we had our Christmas luncheon. You know, wherever you work, everybody has a Christmas luncheon. You know, you go out to a nice place, and the bosses pay for everything, or you go to somebody's house, and it's, you know, you bring in food, and da-da-da. So we had that at a sort of a frou-frou restaurant there in Atlanta. Anyway, long story short, I got Employee of the Year. Not bragging, I got it. I get my award, get my picture taken with the judges and all these muckety-mucks, and I come back. This was December 95, and I come back and sit down, and I'm just like high as a kite. I'm like, oh, my God, this is great. Could this day get any better? The waiter comes over and says, are you Mr. Hudson? I said, yeah, and he said, I've got a call for you at the front desk. I'm like, holy shit, who knows I'm here? Except for everybody in the room. And so I go up there and I said, this is Scott Hudson. And I hear, hey, Scooter, this is DDP. And it was Paige, whom I had gotten to know from doing the local show in Georgia. And he said, I got somebody who wants to talk to you. Hang on. And then the next thing I heard was, Scott, this is Eric Bischoff. I've followed your work. I've seen tapes of you. We've got an opening for an announcer. I think you would be a good fit. Can you be here Tuesday morning to audition? I said, of course. Are you kidding me? Yeah, absolutely. So that Tuesday morning, I went in and sat at the in the lobby there at the CNN Center at the WCW Production Studios, and Keith Mitchell, who was an angel on earth and a godsend of a human being, stuck his head out and said, are you Scott? I said, I am. He said, hold tight. We'll be with you one second. Terrific. Well, 20 minutes later, Keith stuck his head out again, and he goes, Scott, we're ready for you. I said, all right, great. So I'm dressed up because it was across the street from my office. I'm in a suit, and I walk in through that door Keith stuck his head out of, and there I am through the door on the set of WCW Pro, and there stands Bobby Heenan, whom I'd never met ever in my life. And Keith goes, Scott, this is Bobby Heenan. Bobby, this is Scott Hudson. This is audition. And he goes, nice to meet you. Oh, Bobby, big fan. Good luck. And then Keith goes, all right, Scott, you're going to pitch to – I mean, make up a match. Who knows what it was? It was Chris Benoit against, you know, God, who knows, General Erection, whoever it was.
Right.
And Scott, you're going to pitch to this match, billboard the show, make up the matches. It doesn't matter. Just fill up 2 minutes. Go to Bobby. You all go back and forth, and then make sure you hit your mark in your time. Ready? In 3, 2, 1, and that was it.
Wow.
And I did it, and I hit my mark, and I hit my time, and it was perfect, one take. And that was it, and they hired me.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Baptism of fire. What a great audition story.
With Bobby Heenan, not someone prone to work with new talent.
Right.
You know, he's grabbing your ass and making inappropriate jokes on the air, and you're trying to keep it focused on, well, my God, Bobby, I don't know what you're talking about, but we've got high voltage coming to the ring right now. You know, you got to keep it focused with him, and God love him. He's fantastic. And yeah, that was it. That's how it happened.
unbelievable. The amount of talent that you had, that you worked with in terms of commentating for the shows for WCW is amazing. Obviously, the Professor, Mike Tenay, Tony Schiavone, Bobby Heenan, yourself. I mean, it was, you know, a dream team. In fact, I think you even commentated with Mark Madden at some point.
Yeah.
How was it working with those different personalities coming in, especially from where you came from that indie promotion, and now going up to the big leagues, working with people like those executives like Eric Bischoff and all those color commentators have been there for years and years. What was that like, stepping into that?
I'll tell you this, and I guarantee you Scott will back me up on this. It helps for two things. Number one, to have no ego, and number two, to be a mark. I mean, I walked in every day and thought, my God, I'm sitting here next to Dusty Rhodes calling wrestling.
Wow.
It doesn't get any better than that. Yeah, you know, I'm like, well, pay me whatever you want. Who cares? I'm calling wrestling with Dusty Rhodes. I'm calling wrestling with Larry Zbyszko. I'm calling wrestling with Bobby Heenan, with Mike Tenay. You know, I had no ego. I don't care. I was just having a blast. I'd do it again tomorrow for the same reason, that I just love the sport and I love those guys. And that's what made it easy. You know, Scotty will tell you the same thing, that it's if you're a mark for the business, which I don't think is a pejorative term at all, but if you're a mark for the business, you never work at this business. Now, in the ring, absolutely you do, because you're getting slammed around and hurt all the time. But as an announcer, unless something really goes off the rails, you're not going to get hurt.
Right.
And you just get to enjoy yourself. And it's everything, and this sounds so terrible, but it's everything you thought it was times a million to be a mark to then become an announcer. And it's a lot of work to get there, but once you're there, it's exactly what you think. It's like, oh my God, I'm calling a match with Michael Hayes, which I got to do one time. Like, oh, this just doesn't get any better.
Wow.
Now, I still feel that way.
I'll add one more to that, is to be a student of the sport too, because there's always something new. So you have to love what you do and study what's going on. I don't want to say everywhere else in the world, but I know I would get matches in from Japan and from Mexico to watch, just so I could see what new was coming out there, because you never know when it's coming here. To go back to the using mark as a pejorative term, because I don't necessarily agree with that either. I had the fortunate happenstance to work with Jerry Lynn on numerous occasions, and the first time I ever met him, I hadn't officially started working as a commentator or anything like that. I was working in an unofficial capacity for TNA. I was actually ghostwriting Jeremy Borash's website column for him, which I don't think anybody but me and him knew, and which is fine by me, whatever. He gave me free tickets to the show, so, and I was thrilled. I was a part of the business at that point. And but I had the happenstance to meet Jerry Lynn after one of the shows, and found myself kind of dumbstruck, because I was a huge, huge fan for Jerry, and those were the first words that left my mouth. It wasn't, "Hi, Jerry, nice to meet you." It was, "Hi, I'm your number one fan." and apologized immediately. I'm sorry. It was such a Mark thing to say. And he stopped me, and he said, "No." He said, "The minute I stop," he was referring to himself, he said, "The minute I stop being a Mark for this business is the minute I get out of it."
Great.
Yeah.
You know, that's so funny you all mentioned that.
That stuck with me for a long time. Well, obviously still today. I mean, that sticks. If you're a mark for the business, like Scott said, you're not working. You're still having fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why we do this show, because we're still fans. And it's interesting you both say that, because that was a question I was going to ask you. Is, you know, what is your thought on the term mark? Now we know, you know, and I don't think that that's a bad thing at all, Stephen. I mean, what do you think about that term and the use of that term mark?
I think people try to make it into a negative thing. I think the internet sort of made the word mark into a dirty word, when in fact everyone is a mark, from the promoter to the wrestler to the fan to the grandfather to the little kid. We all want to see the Freebirds jump the Von Erichs, or vice versa. That's why we watch. That's the magic. That's the pull. We become marks because we're worked so well, and we want to work people too. So there's no reason to make it into a negative term or say, well, I'm a smart mark, so I'm different than a mark. It's just a love of professional wrestling, because it really is a very, when done right, it's really nothing better in a dramatic athletic setting. There really is nothing better than Dusty Rhodes Like I just saw the other day in an old Mid-South promo in Louisiana, cutting a promo on the Russians, literally crying about how he was going to take. I mean, those moments are just magic, and they keep us even when the shows get stale, like maybe sometimes they get lately.
You know, it's funny. Scott Hudson mentioned about, you know, working with the Dream. You know, obviously we lost the Dream and we lost the Hot Rod, you know, not too long ago. Both of you may have had an opportunity to meet or work with those legends. I'll start with Mr. Hudson first. What type of memories, if at all, can you share about the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes?
Dusty, for better or for worse, Dusty as a character that everyone experienced on television, and me from, you know, growing up in South Georgia, I remember Dusty as a heel with Dick Murdoch working the Florida territory. That's what I remember Dusty from, being, you know, 7 years old and hating Dusty. And then he turned on Pac Song with Gary Hart and that famous match at the Fort Heschley Armory in Tampa. I go back that far with Dusty as a fan, and then get to know him. The one thing I remember about Dusty Rhodes was that he was never anything except himself. That if you listen to Dusty on the air and he's doing this, man, that was too sweet to be sour and all that bullshit, he didn't talk like that in real life. He was a very intelligent, well-spoken man who did not have a lisp at all. But when you saw him on television or when you talked to him backstage, it was the same guy. He just put on a different, you know, vocal technique. And you never, ever questioned what Dusty thought. You never questioned what he said, or at least his motivation. You could say, I disagree, that's one thing, but you knew it was the truth. He wasn't working you. That Dusty would tell you everything straight up, honest, from the beginning. And I'll give you an example of this. I got a call from a friend of mine a couple of days ago, Friday, who's, let's see, I think it's his nephew. The WWE is doing something about having little kids announce NXT shows on the network. That's mm-hmm. something they've got coming up. And they're taking auditions to have little kids be announcers. Mm-hmm. I mean, like little kids, not like 18-year-old. I mean, like 10-year-old.
Right.
And, you know, whatever. That's right. But his nephew, I think, is going to do it. And he said, what's some advice I can give his mom to do that? I said, the first thing they're going to do is tell him they're going to talk to him through his IFB, through his earpiece. They're going to talk to him nonstop, and he's got to be able to keep talking while he's listening. And I said, don't let him listen to Dusty Rhodes, because if you watch Dusty when everything was hot and heavy with WCW and Dusty's doing the announcing on a live show only, that you would hear Dusty going on and on and on, and he would stop, and it would be silence. And then he would go, yeah, 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 that's right, and start putting over whatever they were telling him in his IFB. And he would just stop talking and listen, and then react to something that the audience didn't hear. And he's going, yeah, yeah, that's right, and nobody said anything. But that was Dusty being real all the time, and that's what, you know, helped him get over as a babyface after the Pac Song turn in 1974, up until he passed away earlier this year, is that everybody related to him because they saw themselves in him, and that was a shoot. That wasn't a work. That wasn't a character. That's exactly who he was.
Wow, that's great stuff. Scott, Barry, how about you? Did you ever get a chance to meet the Dream or the Hot Rod?
I got the chance to meet Dusty and Roddy. Never got a chance to work with either of them, but got a chance to work with people they had touched, like Scott Hudson, James Storm, Cassidy Riley, everybody in the TNA locker room. He was pivotal in TNA for a long time, and that's kind of where I got my start and people who I started meeting first. So I got to meet and be around people who he had touched and see how he would work through those people. I had never gotten a chance to work with Dusty. Like I said, just met him a couple of times. Same with Roddy, just had met him a couple of times. But as a fan and later in my career, as I got out of the commentary and started doing the managing, both Dusty and Roddy were huge influences on me without them even knowing it. You know, Dusty, like Scott was saying, Dusty was real. He was relatable. He would connect to the common man. He dined with kings and queens, and he ate pork and beans. He fell on hard times, but you know, and that portrayed. I tried to do that when I was doing the managing. When I was trying to do the commentary, you know, what am I seeing? What do I need to relate that I know that the fan watching at home isn't going to know? You know, how can I just relate to those people? And then with Roddy, and I'm sure Scott Hudson's got far more Roddy stories than I do, but the fact that Roddy was always just unpredictable, that you know, you never knew where Piper was coming from, what he was going to say, or when he was going to say it. I took that maybe a little too close to heart in some of my managerial skills when I caused a couple riots and had a couple knives pulled on me at once.
You see, Scott, you know, that's what happens when you go back to those old videos from back in the day or the Carlos Colon era. You know, you're getting
that's
a lot of
heat. When I was doing the managing thing, that's what I wanted to have the audience forget it was a show for 5 minutes. And they forgot it was a show, and I got in trouble. So, but that, you know, Rod was a huge influence on that. And I know with Scott's time in WCW and he on TNA, I know he's got far better Roddy stories than I do, and I got to shake his hand and say, "Hi, Roddy, I'm a huge fan. You're a huge influence." That's about the extent that I had with those two.
Well, Mr. Hudson, talk about the Hot Rod. I mean, you know, he came in, and one of the things I remember is, you know, him being the powers that be, and so many other different angles, of course, him and Hogan, and showing up at a Halloween Havoc, no doubt. What's a memory you can share of maybe the Hot Rod?
I'll give you two.
Okay.
First off, I've mentioned before, I am old. I am an old, old man. I graduated high school in 1982. And that was when Roddy Piper was the co-host of Georgia Championship Wrestling with Gordon Solie. And, you know, the babyface turn against Don Morocco, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I was there for all of that, or at least in Georgia watching the show for all of that. And what I remember about Roddy first, and this is strictly personal, is that when I'm watching Roddy in high school, back then I had hair. I mean, hell, everybody did in high school. I haven't had hair in, you know, 28 years or whatever, but back then I did, and I had long, thick hair, and I was an athlete. I played football and all these other sports, and I was such a mark, I kept telling all my friends who were marks too, I said, look, I don't know what it's going to take, but I am going to find a way to be a professional wrestler. I knew this much, and it was a work to an extent. I said, I'm going to be a professional wrestler, and I am going to come in to Georgia Championship Wrestling, and I am going to be Scotty Piper, Roddy's little brother. And we're going to figure out a way to work an angle. I don't even know those were the words that you used at the time. But I said, I'm going to find a way to work an angle, and I'm going to come in as Roddy's little brother. I'm going to be Scotty Piper, and it's going to be Scotty and Roddy Piper. It's going to be me and him. We're going to tear the house down, you know, coast to coast, border to border. So that's what Roddy Piper meant to me.
Wow.
And then when we get into WCW, he came in, and we did, I can't remember which one it was. Actually, it might have been a Havoc, now to think about it, mm-hmm. to bring it full circle. Where we did Roddy and Hulk for the umpteen thousandth time, and Roddy did this bit where he was training at Alcatraz, and I went out for that. Me and I can't remember who all else. This was before the Russo Ferrara days.
Right.
I can't remember who went out there with us for that. It might have been Terry Taylor, but they wanted me to go in case they needed somebody there to be an interview, like. Roddy Piper, you know, I just stumbled across you here at Alcatraz, you know, that kind of stuff.
I ended up
not being on camera at all, but I was out there to watch him doing all that stuff, and Piper was a legit tough guy. Yeah. He wasn't all show. He was like, he could take care of himself.
Right.
I mean, a lot of the guys out there pretend to be tough guys and could kick my ass every day of the week, but aren't real tough guys when it comes to it. Piper was tough. He would beat people up. And I just remember watching this, like, I had no idea that Roddy was this insane about training and fighting and knowing how to take care of himself. And I'd heard all the stories about growing up on the streets and being homeless at 13 and all this other stuff, but it was a shoot. And he was literally a self-made guy. I mean, from when he was you know, 13, 14 years old, he's been doing it all on his own with no help from his folks or his family or anybody else. And, you know, people forget that about Piper because he's such a genuinely nice guy. But people forget that he really was that. He would have been and was on the street if not for what he made of himself, with, you know, pulling himself up by his own bootstraps and all those other cliches. That's who he was, and that's the best thing you can say about anyone, is that they are who they are strictly because of their talent. They didn't inherit anything. They didn't have a silver spoon shoved in their mouth. They didn't have a trust fund to go to college for 10 years. They really made every dime they ever had in their life based on their ability and their skill, and that was Piper.
That's amazing stuff, man. You mentioned this earlier, talking about being produced on air, people in the back in the truck telling you what to say, what bullet points to hit, this, that, and the other. And in today's product, when we watch, and I really am a big fan of the announcers anyway, you know, seeing what all they have to do and how they're told to say things, I don't necessarily think that a lot of the faults of today's announcing team is the fault of the announcer as much as it might be the fact that they are being told what to say. How difficult is it, and how much producing did you get, Scott, on air during a Thunder or during your pay-per-view or event? And what do you think about how announcers have evolved to this point?
Well, the premise of your question is the answer to your question. In WCW, it was, I put myself in this hierarchy. It was Tony. It was Mike. It was Legend. It was Dream. It was Brain. It was Lee. It was Mean Gene. God knows it was Chris Cruz. It was Eric. And then somewhere below all of that comes me. And we were all marks, but we had all worked to get where we were. We didn't need anybody producing us. We knew that sometimes you just sit back and don't say anything and let the drama in the ring tell the story. Sometimes what's in the ring is shit, and you better find some way to make the people care, because they're going to start turning away. And you just learn that. It's like, you know, being a football player. At some point, you don't have to say, do you know how to, at the NFL, you don't say, do you know what it means to trap block? God knows, that guy's, he's done if you have to say that to him. With announcers, it should be the same way. You don't have to come in and tell them the fundamentals, the basics. And in WCW, that's the way it was. But now they've got so many people in every group, in, you know, especially in the WWE, who have either never known anything but that, or are being force-fed that from the very beginning, because that's all they know. And that's just really sad that so many guys are brought in to announce the biggest promotion in the world, and basically being told what to say instead of knowing how to call it on the fly. But then again, that's what happens in the business. You ask guys, you know, what happens in the ring, and they'll go, oh, well, we rehearse it all day. The agents lay out every move, and we know every move and the time it takes, and we're supposed to go 8 minutes and 45 seconds to 9 minutes, and then somewhere in that 15 seconds we have to hit the finish and, you know, do the beauty shot out, and they've laid it out like a ballet instead of like Flair and Steamboat at WrestleWar 89, where they didn't even talk. The only thing they knew was the finish, and never talked, and worked 35 minutes of what is, to my opinion, the best match in the history of wrestling, and didn't even talk about it. They were just that good, and that's what announcers should be doing, and they're not.
Yeah. That's what wrestlers should be doing, and they're not.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And Mr. Hudson, is that in a sense what you were speaking about with Michael Cole, that Michael Cole is sort of a manufactured entity more so than an actual announcer, that, you know, he sort of has become what Vince McMahon wanted and was in the early 90s? He almost seems to have become Vince McMahon in some strange way.
Oh, have you seen the photos of him recently where he's, yeah, like all jacked up and shredded? And I mean, I'll give him 1,000 points of credit. He looks fantastic now. He's like got abs and, you know, lats and traps and pecs, and he looks amazing,
right,
over the last year. But your point is well taken. He's Vince. He's got his haircut. He's got his intonation. He's got his inflection. He's got his verbiage, his nomenclature, and now he's got his body, although Michael and I'm not making any kind of assumptions here, is probably about 50 pounds lighter than Vince.
Right.
But he's Vince, and, you know, if Vince was a good announcer, he'd still be an announcer. He was good. He wasn't great. Michael Cole is awful if he's not good.
That's interesting observation. You know, I when Michael Cole joined the WWF, you could see him going from backstage announcer and morphing, and I believe that he was that clay that Vince could mold because he was new. No one else had touched him, and I think that is a tribute to his success. Well, his success today or longevity in the company is the fact that Vince could mold him. Working with all the tremendous talent you did, Scott, on air, you know, working with the Tenays and working with a living legend, those great broadcasters, is there a particular moment or story that stands out to you as a funny bit of unscriptedness that happened at one of your tapings between the talent and yourself?
Not really. I know that's a great question, but the truthful answer, which is what I'll give you every time, is that when it came to us, we were given free rein to announce. And at some point, we weren't told what was going to happen. You know, we didn't know the finish. I mean, we didn't know, forget the finishing sequence, we didn't know who was going over. So our emotion would be raw, and no pun intended, but our emotion would be real, and, you know, and it would seem more real to the audience. But as far as when we would become involved with stuff, they weren't taking any chances. They would let us know what was happening. I guess the biggest exception to that would have been the Bash at the Beach in 2000,
yeah,
with the deal with Vince and Hulk, which to this day you will get arguments on both sides, probably from Vince and Hulk and everybody else, that was it a shoot, was it a work? But we had no idea that was coming, and that was an eye-opener. And if you go back and watch that show, I guess it's on YouTube. I'm sure it's on the network somewhere.
Oh, yes.
It is that what you hear, I think it was me and Mark and Tony, we all had these Hawaiian shirts on because we were at the beach.
Yeah.
We went out that afternoon and we were like, you know, Vince Russo came in and said, I want you guys wearing Hawaiian shirts. Like, Hawaiian shirts? Do we look like we bring Hawaiian? Do we have Hawaiian shirts? Go find some. So we go down to the beach, literally, and find these Hawaiian shirts. And but if you watch that show, everything you hear from us is a shoot. I don't know if it was a shoot between Vince and Hulk or not, or what the deal was, but I know with us, we didn't know it was coming, and what you hear is a complete shoot from the three of us, including lines like, that's not in the format.
Yeah.
We didn't discuss this at the production meeting, that kind of stuff. But that was legit.
It seemed like it was so real, and you all were reacting to it, which is something that we don't see these days, you know, and it was incredible. And I remember seeing that unfold as a fan. And Scott, maybe during that time, I'm trying to remember, Scott, were we at college during that time? I'm trying to remember when all that went down, but it was just a crazy time. Now, you mentioned how you were feeling on air at that time. What was it like after the show, when things wrapped up, Scott? You were, you know, and you guys leave the desk, you guys go in the back. What was the scene like at that point?
Well, the main players were gone. Hulk was gone. Vince was gone. Jeff Jarrett and Booker were both there, but either they are the best workers, like not in the ring, but backstage in the world, and they're not. They're both just terrifically honest, nice men.
Right.
Probably two of the best I've ever met in the business. Or they were caught flat-footed like we all were. So I backstage, it was another backstage after a pay-per-view that was actually pretty good. People remember the stuff with Vince and Hulk, but forget, that was a hell of a good show. And so we walked backstage and we're like, what was all that about? I'm like, the hell if I know, but wasn't the show good? Wasn't the undercard great? Like, yeah, it sure was. And off we go. And the main players were gone.
You were there for the final broadcast of WCW Nitro. I remember that night like it was yesterday. I was in two rooms in my home. I had Raw taping on a videotape in one side and Nitro on the other side. And I kept those tapes, and I'm sure I still have them in my room at my parents' house somewhere, you know. But having said that, what was your thought, WCW last show being bought by the WWF, WWE now, and what was your thought going into the show, and how was it in the aftermath and the wake that followed?
Well, I had the great fortune of working for Tony Schiavone. Tony, in addition to being the lead announcer, was the manager, the boss of all of the announcers. He was our boss. If we had something going on, Tony was the boss. And he let us know that, you know, you can't say anything, don't call the sheets, don't call Scott Barry, don't do anything, but we're being bought by the WWF. And you know, all this stuff with Fusion Media and all the stuff with Jerry Jarrett, none of that has panned out. We're done. Monday night is our last show. And, you know, so I knew, and the announcers knew, but I don't think any of the talent or any of the crew knew. And when we got to the show, which is in Panama City Beach on a Club La Vila, we have a production meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning, and we go over everything, and that's when everybody found out. That, you know, Jerry Briscoe was there. I know Jimmy Hart was there. Obviously, Shane was there. I think Bruce Pritchard was there. And they could not have been nicer. I mean, there was no heat. Once everybody knew, you know, it's wrestling. It's a work. Everybody's kissing Jerry Briscoe's ass. Everybody's kissing Shane's ass. Everybody's kissing Bruce's ass. You know, trying to make sure they got a spot, you know, after the buyout. But I wasn't interested in that. So I was just like saying goodbye. It was people I work with. It was like, if you've ever been at a job that goes out of business, you know, that last day, you know, people that you've worked with so closely, you know, hugs and tears and let's don't lose touch. Here's my email address. Here's my, you know, my phone number. And, you know, that's what it was like. And when we got to the arena there for Nitro, and we knew that we only had an hour to do, hour and change, I guess, to do, and we were going to finish it with Sting and Flair, I remember talking to Tony. Because I think it was just me and Tony. Mark had done something to piss somebody off and was gone by then. But I think it was just me and Tony. It was like, I said, if this is the way we're going out, man, we've got to leave it right out here by the ring. I mean, this is the last anybody's going to hear of WCW. This has got to be flawless, perfect. We've got to put over the product and, you know, screw Vince and screw them and screw everybody. If this is the last they hear of this company, it's going to be perfect. And it was. You go back and watch that match, you can hear a lot of emotion from Tony and I doing that show, because we knew that it was the end and it was the last anybody would hear of the company. And, you know, it was tough. And I'll tell you this story. When the show was over, a rephrase, when Nitro was over, the show went on as a simulcast of Raw for another hour and change, but we were done. We went backstage and, you know, hugs and tears from, I won't call any names, but the toughest guys in the world, we're all hanging on each other, just crying our eyes out because we knew that it was the last time we would work together under these, it's starting to get to me now, under those auspices. And when we had said our goodbyes and everything was over, Tony grabs me and he goes, "What time is your flight?" I said, "It's like 6 o'clock in the morning." He goes, "Screw it. Let's go get in my rental car and drive back to Atlanta." So I grabbed my bags. I threw them in Tony's rental, and we drove back to Atlanta. I left at like 10:45 at night, and that's probably a six-hour drive back, a five-hour drive back from the beach. And all we did was talk wrestling. We talked about our histories in the sport and who we liked and who we hated and the best times we had and, you know, what we were going to do next and all that. And so it was 5 hours of I wouldn't trade anything for it. And he dropped me off at the airport, and I picked up my car and I drove home. But that was the last Nitro for me, and the last Nitro for me will always be that drive home with Tony Schiavone.
Amazing.
Scott, tell him about, because I still enjoy this story, tell him about the difference between your time at WCW and your one night at WWE.
Yeah, I was really interested to hear about the Tacoma Raw.
Oh, God. first, from a production standpoint, and I've told Scott this, I think actually probably, well, I'm sure the statutes run or the rules have lapsed. I think I've actually shown Scott some of the formats of Nitro, and those Nitro formats were like 30 pages.
Wow.
And it had everything. It would be like general erection versus the Wall, and you know, from there it doesn't have the finish. It's got the match and then the time of the match, and you got a window for the time, and then it was like the you know, taste the rainbow or fruit flavor Skittles replay of the week.
Oh, let me just point this out.
A 1-800-COLLECT commercial. I mean, it was laid out to a fairly well.
Well, let me just point this out real quick, because you've mentioned Hugh Morris' General Erection at least 3 or 4 times in this. Are you a big fan of Hugh Morris at all, Bill DeMott?
No.
You know
no,
what?
No.
That's just the name everyone remembers from that year for some reason. That gimmick had some sort of traction because everyone remembers that General Erection gimmick so well. They don't remember Hugh Morris or Bill DeMott so much as General Erection. There's something about that name.
I know, that was Scott's favorite.
Well, I mean, my God, aren't we all 13 years old still? Jesus, we bring out a guy and say, here he is, folks, General Hugh G. Erection, wink, wink, nod, nod, with major guns.
Yeah, yeah.
And here's What's-Her-Face coming out with, you know, fake boobs that are, you know, 48 double Ds.
Yeah, I remember.
13-year-old is going to remember that. We're all 13 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Tylene Buck was not bad to look at, for sure. Good times.
No, she's, and actually a very, very nice woman. I got, not all of them were, but she was. She was terrific. She was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's cool.
Her guns notwithstanding, she was a very nice woman.
Guns ablazing. Okay, sorry to interrupt. Okay, so you had a story, Scott Barry, you wanted Scott to talk about.
Oh, I was back the difference between the Nitro
broadcast
and that single one Tacoma Raw broadcast and then never again.
Okay, that's not true. And here's the truth. Nitro was laid out on a 30-page format. I get to Raw to do the Tacoma. I mean, I get to Tacoma to do the Raw, rather, where we're going to do the thing with me and Arn and coming out with Stacy and have Booker and Buff and blah, 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 and blow off the show with Shane and all that other stuff. And I'm thinking, okay, well, 10 o'clock, production meeting. Forget that. Production meeting at 2 o'clock. Okay, well, what about pre-tapes? Well, I'll forget pre-tapes. We'll do them during the show.
What?
Well, that's not really pre-taped, is it?
Oh.
And it's like pre-taped like 10 minutes before it airs. And I'm like, okay, well, where's the format? Here it is. And it's like a half a sheet of paper.
Really?
Like, holy shit, how are we supposed to do, how do you guys do a show? And I'm hanging out with Paul Lee, who was there at the time. I'm like, this is not how you do television. And he goes, no, it's how they do television.
Oh,
I'll never forget that line. I said, okay, terrific. I only got one match and one segment. I think I can handle this, but I can't imagine doing a show like that. So we do the show, and Scott, here you go. The next night, we did Tacoma again for SmackDown, and Booker and Buff was an abortion. I mean, make no mistake about it.
Yeah.
They came out and worked a WCW-style match, which is side headlocks and top wrist locks and, you know, body scissors, and nobody wants to see that when you're supposed to be launching the new company. You're supposed to go out and go balls to the wall and leave it in the ring. And they're out there working like a house show in Greenville.
Yeah.
And it died. And Arn and I remember Arn and I sitting at ringside, and Arn grabbed a, you know, we had pad and paper there, and he just wrote, this sucks, like S-U-X, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. And we weren't on camera. I looked over, and I'm like rolling my eyes, nodding my head, trying to, but this is the greatest thing ever, Arn. What do you think? And he's writing, this sucks. Like, oh, this is awesome. But anyway, we did SmackDown the next night in Tacoma in the same building, and it was completely different. It was Palumbo and Stasiak and Jindrak and O'Hare. I can't remember what exactly they were in, but they worked a four-man tag, and we did the same bit. I think we even came out with Stacy again, and we did the same thing. And they tore the house down. It was an incredible match, but nobody remembers it because Raw with Booker and Buff was so terrible. And that's all that Vince remembered. And when I got to Atlanta the next week for Raw, Kevin Dunn comes up to me and he goes, Vince hated it. We're going to scuttle the whole thing. And I was supposed to do another, Arn and I was supposed to do another match on Raw from Atlanta. And that was it. He and I would do a match on Raw from Tacoma, a match on SmackDown from Tacoma, and then a match on Raw from Atlanta. And that was it. That was all we were ever asked to do. And as it turned out, we never did the third one. I did like some backstage interview with Tori Wilson or something.
Wow.
Did you feel like that match actually ended that? Because, you know, the word going around was that they were really going to have this great WCW show and keep it going. And, you know, just for me personally, that's just such a sad thing WCW, its lineage back to like Georgia Championship Wrestling and Mid-Atlantic is really the best wrestling I've ever seen. The Four Horsemen, Dusty Rhodes, the Briscoes, all of it. To end that way, you know, it just seems so awful that Vince McMahon would control it at the very end, and it would end from a match being poor. That doesn't seem fair to the people that loved NWA and WCW wrestling so much.
I agree. And after the fact, we found out that Vince never had any inclination, any desire to let WCW get over on its own. His whole purpose the entire time was to bury WCW and ECW. That it was, they were brought in, and I don't know how old you guys are, but if you remember back when Jim Crockett bought out Bill Watts as UWF.
I remember.
Back in 1987, and he brought in all of this UWF talent. Watts was on his last legs financially, and Crockett pulled him out of the mire and, you know, gave Cowboy some money, and off we go, and he gets all this talent. And everybody had the same idea. Oh, my God, it's going to be the NWA versus the UWF. You know, we're going to have Ric Flair versus Terry Gordy for 3 months for a unification series that'll end in the pay-per-view. We had everything. And all Crockett wanted to do was bury the UWF talent. That was it. Some of them, like Sting, more over than anyone else, got over on their own, despite the best efforts of the Crockett booking mindset. It's the exact same thing that Vince did with WCW. Some of the WCW talent, like Ray Jr., Booker T, they got over on their own, despite Vince's best efforts. And some of the ECW talent, specifically Rob Van Dam, got over because they were talented. But Vince did everything he could to bury everybody from those groups, and basically did. You know, there were a few exceptions here and there. You know, he'll say, well, go back and look. We had The Undertaker and Kane against Chronic. We had Goldberg against Lesnar. We had Page against Undertaker. But they were all guaranteed to make the WCW guys completely fall flat on their face and just be buried. They were never meant to be more than a one-off angle that paid off at either the Invasion pay-per-view or a pay-per-view or two or three later, and that was it. And that's just ego on Vince's behalf. But then again, I've said this before in a couple of other interviews, that he won. You know, the Monday Night Wars are over, and he won. And so he gets to write the history. Does it mean it's correct? No. Is it correct? Absolutely not. He's lying through his teeth. But he won. So his version is the one that counts.
Interesting you say that, because they are really milking the fact that the Monday Night Wars are back. That nostalgia is still going on in the WWE Network. The specials are among the most watched specials on the network when it comes to WCW.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had an opportunity to sample any of that stuff on the network at all?
I've seen it, yeah, absolutely. And again, it's obvious that he won, you know. I'm not going to tell you that everything that you see on the network is factually correct or accurate, but it doesn't matter. He won, and what he says goes. You know, to the victor goes the spoils, and to the man that won the Monday Night Wars, and that was Vince McMahon, he gets to write the history. And if he wants to say that I was the world's first, you know, incontinent, you know, special education announcer ever to make it to that level, you know, I'm not, but if that's what he says, he won, he can say that.
Wow.
Well, maybe not the first, maybe the second or third.
that's true. Ron Trongard did have a show for a while.
Wow. That's good times right there. Yeah.
So in a sense, Vince McMahon cares more about ego than money itself, because he lost a tremendous amount of money botching what would have been a great angle. Is that what you...
Absolutely.
Okay. That's what...
There's no better way to put that. Whatever you just said, write that down. That's perfect. Because the bottom line is, would Vince McMahon rather make $700 million a year and be able to bury WCW and ECW, or make $1 billion a year and put them over?
Wow.
That's what it came down to.
Ugh.
I know that we our time is very limited, and Mr. Hudson, thank you so much for your time, and Scott Berry, always good to hang out with you. A couple quick questions, maybe a word or person association game we'll play with you before we hang up. But TNA has gone through so much, and with Scott and myself and Steve being Nashville boys, you know, we've seen TNA rise, and now we see it, you know, I guess in its decline, as it were. But you were there at the very beginning. Can you tell us how you got involved with TNA and what some of your memories of TNA are?
The easy answer is when I was working, to bring it full circle, when I was working with Burt Prentice, whom I hold in the highest regard, by the way, with USA Wrestling in Nashville. That was, I won't say that USA Wrestling morphed into TNA. It did not. But a lot of the talent that was featured in USA Wrestling there in Nashville moved over to TNA, specifically James Storm and Chris Harris, as well as Chase Stevens and Andy Douglas, the Naturals, four guys that I think, though James Storm is, you know, now about to come into his own, it looks like those four guys, I think, were probably the four of the best tag team wrestlers of the 2000s, up until 2010. Just no question about it for me. But when we were working USA Wrestling, I did a couple of shows with Jim Cornette as my co-host, and a couple of with the legend, Larry Zbyszko, as my co-host. That all morphed somehow, you know, sideways and, you know, drips and drabs and turns to TNA. And when TNA started, Vince Russo was part of it. I don't think it was known, but Vince was very much in the shadows writing the first, 7 or 8 months of television before they even hit the airways. That's when they were doing those weekly pay-per-views on Wednesday night. Mm-hmm. And Vince was in Atlanta. I'm sorry?
I used to order those, believe it or not.
Yeah,
me too.
They're great.
I ordered every one, every Wednesday pay-per-view, whether I was on it or not, I ordered it and recorded it if I was on it, and it was a great show.
It was.
You never know who was going to show up. And so Vince lived in Atlanta. He was running a record store, and I would go over to his record store, and we would talk about what he was going to do with, what him and Jeff were going to do with TNA. And then when he finally told me they were going to have their launch in Huntsville, I called Tony Schiavone, and I said, Tony, Vince, and he had asked me, are you interested? I said, absolutely not. I'm done. I'm finished. You know, Tacoma was over. You know, my name was mud. I want nothing more to do with the business, but I want to go. So he told me they were going to do in Huntsville and launch the pay-per-view and launch the company. So I called Schiavone. I said, Tony, we got to go to this. This looks like fun. And he goes, great. So Tony drove over to my house. We all piled in my car. I think me and him and Steve Prazak, drove over to Huntsville, Alabama, which, 2.5 hours from Atlanta, and we were backstage at the show, and just, you know, some of it was terrible, like the guy named Cheeks, this huge fat guy that tore down the ring, and two guys dressed up like penises or something, I don't remember, the Johnson Brothers, that stuff sucked. But other stuff that they did, which was the lion's share of the show, was just incredible. Yeah. And so we were there from the very beginning, although we weren't on the show. And then out of nowhere, Goldilocks, who I think is just one of the great talents of this business that has been ignored and forgotten in the fog of time, she was the backstage announcer at TNA, and they realized you've got this girl who is insanely good looking. She is drop dead. Scotty will tell you, she's drop dead gorgeous in person.
Oh, we know Goldie very well.
And on television too. And she's so talented, and they're wasting her as the backstage interview. So, you know, Jeff and Vince call me and goes, look, can you come be backstage interview? We've got big plans for Goldie. If you can come do that, we got something we want to do with her. I said, great. So I get up there, and the first thing I do is go to Goldie and say, look, I'm not taking your spot. They called me. They've got plans for you. And she goes, I know, I've heard, you know, hugged it out. And to this very day, here at the end of 2015, she and I are still great, great, very, very close personal friends. We've, you know, shared time with our families together and all that. So that worked out. But that was it. You know, they had something else to do with Goldilocks and brought me in to be backstage. And when they moved to Orlando, you know, there's no commuting from Atlanta to Orlando by car every Wednesday afternoon. You know, Nashville was one thing, but Orlando's something else. So that was it. That's when I washed my hands.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those were interesting times, and you know, Scott Barry and I, and we know Goldilocks very well, as I used to be a radio announcer here in Nashville as well, and had Goldie and her band on, and did a couple after parties with the guys from AMW and the Naturals, a bunch of local talent here. So that's great. That's great. I'll have to let her know that we have common friendship now. So
I think the world of her. I would follow her into battle. I would take a bullet for her. Anything she needs, anytime.
That's great. Yeah,
she's excellent.
She's a phenomenal person, and a good follow on Facebook and Twitter too, because she's always posting motivational pictures, and she's posting motivational videos, and she's doing workout bodybuilding kind of stuff now, and she's still got the band going on, and she's just she got out of TNA, and I think that was probably a good move for her professionally, because she seems to be just loving life right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's excellent.
Yeah.
A tremendously underrated promo.
I tell you, her and Eric Watts, that was good times there at TNA back in the day. Let's wrap some things up. I really appreciate it. Let's do some word association before we let you go, Scott, and feel sure. free, Scott Barry, to chime in and as well. Let's talk about this. If I say a name of a superstar, feel free to give a sentence or two in your thoughts about this superstar. Ric Flair.
I'll quote Bret Hart, who actually I hold as in high regard as almost anybody in the business. Ric Flair wrestled the same match every night. It was a great match, but it was the same match every night. And Ric Flair is a cautionary tale that at some point you've got to realize you've got to grow up. You've got to save your money. You've got to pay your bills. You've got to become a grown-up. And I love Rick to death, just one of the great guys ever. I just wish that now, as Rick is 65 years old, I wish he had grown up when he was 40.
Yeah.
Because he might have more of his fortune still left than he does now.
Sting.
An underrated talent in the ring. Sting was not going to carry somebody to a five-star match, but there is not a hand in this business that couldn't carry Sting to a five-star match. But regardless of what happens inside the ropes, there are precious few guys that I encountered in this business that I would trust to babysit my daughter. He's one of them.
Right on. Let's go with Vince Russo.
Wow. you want to take that one, Scott?
Well, Ring of Glory certainly pops to mind. I'll give Russo a lot of credit. I think Russo is a tremendously creative fire, but fire is probably the right word. If he's uncontrolled, he is a wild son of a gun and comes up with some, you know, the Ding Dongs and the Johnsons and the Cheeks of the world, but he's got a mind. He knows when he wants to write something good, he can write something good. We'll put it that way. He's a creative fire, and like fire, uncontrolled is bad.
That's a perfect analogy, and I'll tell you this. I love Vince Russo as a person and as a coworker, and for a while, he wasn't really my boss, but as someone whose direction and creativity I was duty-bound to follow. I love Vince Russo. I have absolutely nothing bad to say about him as a man and as a creative artist. But I agree with Scott that he needs to have some sort of governor on him to pull him back from making so many crash TV-style booking decisions that it harms the overall product. But I would rather have Vince Russo than Kevin Dunn.
But I will say this about him. He found a way to make every match meaning. There wasn't really ever a filler match with a Russo show. Everybody right. had a purpose. Even if it was only a purpose for one show and one show only, it still had a purpose in that show.
And Exhibit A of that is the artist formerly known as Prince Iaukea. Yeah. Who in the hell would have ever come up with that except Vince?
Oh, wow. Yep. Yeah, you see, and Paisley, there you go. There you go. How about this? Tony Schiavone.
Greatest announcer in the history of our sport.
God, I knew that was coming. He's not. And he'll tell you the same thing. The greatest announcer in the history of the sport was Lance Russell, and Jim Ross is in second. But Tony's in third. I'll tell you guys something Tony told me probably in my third day there. He said, and keep in mind, I've watched Tony since I was in college, I guess, last year of college when Tony started on Georgia Championship Wrestling, when he came down from Crockett after that aborted Ole Anderson run. So I've been watching Tony for, by this point, 10, 12 years, I guess. And, you know, he introduced himself, you know, I'm going to be your boss, boom, 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 boom. And he goes, look, you're going to be an announcer for World Championship Wrestling. An announcer will not add one viewer to the show, but a bad one can chase away thousands.
Wow.
And I never forgot that. And that was in maybe early January 1996. He told me that. And to this day, and especially through the time in WCW, I never forgot that I was not going to chase anybody away. I might not bring anybody in, but I wasn't going to chase anybody out the front door or make them change the channel.
Wow. And last one, Double J, Jeff Jarrett.
I can't say enough good about him. In 2001, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I know that Jeff's wife, Jill, had been diagnosed with breast cancer a little bit before that. And when my mom was going through her treatment and I would show up at Nitro, he and I would swap stories. She was further along in her treatment than my mom was, and we would talk about what's coming next. And Jeff's wife ended up passing away, and my mom did too. But I remember being at a Nitro, I think this is after Jill had died, that I was on the phone in the building in the empty arena, or not empty, but just before the people got there, and my mom had called, and she was having a really bad day with her treatments, and I'm in, you know, God knows wherever I was, Milwaukee, somewhere. And I said, Mom, I got somebody I want you to talk to. And I'm on my cell phone. And I said, Jeff, will you talk to my mom? And he talked to her for like 30 minutes. And just, he was Jeff. You know, he was Jeff Jarrett. And made her feel so good. And after that, no matter what kind of bullshit Jeff pulled, beating people, you know, saying slap nuts, hitting people with a gimmick guitar, she loved Jeff. And I did too for the same reason.
Amazing.
I've got a lot of respect for the Jarrett family myself, including Jerry and Jeff. And I actually went to high school with Jeff's, I think it was his younger brother, Jarrett. I can't think of his name. He was 2 years ahead of me. He graduated ahead of me. But Jeff and Jerry would come to the school and come to the wrestling matches, and I would kind of catch glimpses of them here and there. But when I first started ghostwriting for TNA and would hang out with the guys after the show, Jeff would come and hang out, and I mean, I was a nobody. I was ghostwriting Jeremy Borash's From the Ring column and then showing up at shows. He had no reason to know who I was or care who I was. But after the first time that we sat and had a really brief conversation, he knew who I was. And to this day, if I run into him somewhere, it takes him a second to remember my name, but he knows me. He comes up, he says hi, and he's like, oh, Scott, you used to do the stuff with TNA and do the backstage stuff and did this and did that. And still thinks I work with Bert Prentice. He always asks me how Bert's doing, and I'm like, well, I haven't worked with Bert in about 10 years, but I'm sure he's doing.
How is Bert doing? I haven't heard from him in years.
He's actually, I ran into Bert at the Tennessee State Fair. He was running the fairgrounds show like he always does. He's doing well. Bert is Bert. You know, after a nuclear holocaust, there's going to be three things left on the earth: cockroaches, Twinkies, and Bert Prentice.
That's awesome.
But Jeff, you know, to this day, Jeff still, you know, like I said, takes him a second, but remembers who I am. I've had the pleasure of working with Jerry for Nashville Pro. He came out to the first show and was instrumental in teaching, not only teaching me, but teaching the other guys, Jamie and Matt, who had never run a show before in their lives. He was very interested. He sat down and shared everything. Jeff would do the same thing for me, you know, every now and then. And I've got nothing but respect for those two. And I hope that, Global Force Wrestling, GFW, yeah. Jeff's new promotion. I hope that sucker takes off and does well for him. I really, really do.
We all do, yeah. We all do too. Last bit, it wouldn't be a Halloween type of episode if we didn't talk about Halloween Havoc, and both Mr. Barry and Mr. Hudson can chime in on this. Any moments from Halloween Havoc that stand out as being wild, crazy, memorable? What are some of your moments you could share with us about Halloween Havoc, Scott?
Hogan Warrior.
Yeah, that was tough.
That was a hard one to watch.
Hard times. That's hard times, Daddy.
All right.
Hogan Warrior, and I'm going to go back to sipping my whiskey.
Oh, wow. Mr. Hudson, how about yourself?
I'm going to go back to 91 in Chattanooga when, believe it or not, in the opening match, you had, and you may want to, if I'll pause and talk slowly for you guys to get a pen out, but how about this? El Gigante, Sting, and the Steiners against Abdullah the Butcher, Scott Hall, Cactus Jack, and Van Vader.
Yeah.
In the Chamber of Horrors match that ended up with Abby in an electric chair getting executed in the middle of a steel cage, and that opened the show.
And then he no-sold the electric chair to death after.
I forgot that was
the electric chair, and he no-sold it.
That's correct.
How can you not
open the show? The chamber open. I've forgotten that.
Well, you know, it was hard because
I was there. I was in Chattanooga at the UCC Arena.
Yeah.
And when we're just upstairs watching, and believe it or not, and this is a total shoot. You know, we had already finished the global run by then, and Steve Prazak and I were still doing the Georgia show. And John Horton, Craig Johnson, who was our broadcast partner on Global, the three of us went up, and we were in the nosebleed seats at the UTC watching this nonsense go down, and sitting like two seats next to us was Jim Herd.
Oh, no.
Who had put all this crap together. And I remember Horton looking at him, looking at Herd going, that's a really effective... or something like, that's a really effective use of your talent, Mr. Hurd. And he sat back down and we're like, you have lost your ever-loving mind. That is Rick and Scott Steiner and Vader and, you know, and Sting, and they're doing an electric chair match? And, you know, I'll never forget that. There's been a thousand things better. It's actually hard to be worse than that. But there have been a million things better than that at Halloween Havoc. But as far as memorable, I'll never forget that image of Abby being executed, electrocuted, in the center of the ring in a cage in Chattanooga.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was Jack trying to keep... single-handedly launched the WrestleCrap website, didn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think you're right. And, of course, Cactus Jack is trying to keep that switch from falling because he keeps on trying to put it up. The camera pans to him, and all of a sudden he's like, oh, I got to keep that switch up.
I mean, there was no room. There was no room to do any spots. There was so much crap everywhere. Yeah. That could have been like three or four matches with those eight guys that they could have had on that show. It was just such a waste. My goodness.
It was 12 minutes and 33 seconds of the Chamber of Horrors. But thank you so much, Mr. Scott Barry. Where can people find you if people are interested in connecting with you? And we definitely would like both of you at some point, either together or separately, to join us for another show, maybe talk more, or at least maybe break down a wrestling show, maybe a pay-per-view. But Scott Barry, do you want people to find you? Are you accessible through social media these days?
No, I'm still accessible through social media. I'm not really doing much except reposting stuff I find funny these days, but you're more than welcome to find me. It's facebook.com/scott.barry, and you can find me on Twitter at I'm not really active on Twitter, but you can find me on there if you really, really want to for whatever random reason, at Fredhead1979. Just hockey reblogs.
Let's go,
that's
Fred.
Become a new passion.
That's right. Let's go, Fred. And by the way, Scott, I'd love for you to come back on a show because we haven't connected in so long, and it's so cool that we're here talking again because we haven't done that in years.
I know. It's been far too long. Far, far, far too long.
Yeah. Mr. Hudson, where can people find you? I mean, are you able to chat with some of your fans? Because I know a lot of fans are like going, you know, Scott, you know, where's Scott?
Thank you. Thanks, Al John, Stephen. But yeah, I'm on Facebook. That's really all I do. I mean, I let my daughter, who is now 15 years old, and Scotty will tell you, she's 15 going on 43, and she has Kick and Snapchat and Tumblr and Twitter and Facebook and God knows what else out there. But she's my social media footprint. But I have Facebook. Please send me a friend request. I basically accept them all and wait for a reason to delete them if there starts to get, you know, too much nudity. The feds kind of frown on that. But yeah, that's it. That's where you can find me anytime.
Well, that's great. Well, I'd love for you guys to come back one day and discuss more wrestling. It's been great. And by the way, Mr. Hudson, big fan. Like I said, you know, in college, you know, the Thunders and the Nitros were definitely something that we all loved. And I think even Scott Barry came over to my apartment during that time, and we definitely played a lot of WCW Nitro video games we had some Nitro parties for sure, but you were definitely a legendary announcer, and we really appreciate your contributions to the world of wrestling, professional wrestling. So thank you for joining
us. That means so much. I just wish there were more of you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Wow, what a great show, Stephen. Pro Wrestling Cast, and yet another first for us. We just wrapped up the interview we just recorded with Scott Hudson and Scott Berry. And once again, thank you so much to both of them for giving of their time and being on Pro Wrestling Cast this week. I cannot wait to have them both back, Stephen.
Well, I hope they'll come on for a pay-per-view or something. I'm really interested to hear both of their opinions of the current product that a lot of people think is stale, you know, and Scott is very opinionated about things like, you know, Ric Flair's wrestling match work and Michael Cole's ability as an announcer and the things that he sees. And I would really like to see what he thought of one of their shows right after he saw it, just like when I do. But he's obviously a fan. I mean, he obviously still watches wrestling. He's a mark. We talked a lot about being a mark on the show and how it's not a bad thing to be a mark. People wouldn't listen to this podcast if they weren't a mark, for example. You know, everyone's a mark. It's okay.
Yeah, and the fact that he is well-versed in other types of wrestling shows and different things. He's just also a great guy, great historian. And he's like us. We are all wrestling fans. And I think there's a reason why we're involved. And I do have mad props for everyone out there that shows their fandom. Albeit, you know, people are opinionated like anything, but we're all very passionate. We're all passionate about what we love, which is pro wrestling. So thank you once again to Scott Hudson. And I put Scott up there, man. I mean, you know, I talk about wrestling and announcers, and you know, I have a great respect for Scott Hudson and Tony Schiavone both. As we're going to talk about in the future, Halloween Havocs and some of our favorite masked wrestlers and this, that, and the other. I have to say that Scott Hudson, his delivery, his voice is unmistakable.
Yeah,
and that it is really great to hear him call a match, because I believe that passion, that professionalism does come across. You know, his respect for the sport, and he does sound like someone that does call sports and is not just trying to just shill and do stuff. And, you know, he knows exactly what's going on. He is a pro broadcaster. And it's also great to reconnect with Scott Barry as well. And I look forward to having my old friend on the show in the future. So great stuff. And once again, tell your friends about Pro Wrestling Cast. We do appreciate you tuning in and subscribing every single week. Stephen, final thoughts?
Wow, that was probably one of the best times I've had doing this show. I mean, that was pretty amazing. The insightful things we learned today that went on in that crucial time in history in wrestling, and I'm just two class acts, those guys, and I can't say enough good about them.
Right on. Where can people find you to follow you on Twitter, Stephen?
They can go order my new album that'll be coming out, or my new single, How Long? My Life Through Noise, on Amazon and iTunes and Spotify. Awesome. Or Dr. Death Mark. There, you see, I promoted myself. It only took me 7 months.
I'm Amazon Prime, too, so I'm going to go buy your album here this week, so that's outstanding.
I'll just follow it to you.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah, I'm going to support you. Also follow me at P Wrestling Cast. You can also find me at Al John Rocks and at Jedi Musketeer 2 for all things Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars, and my varied podcasts like WDW Teak Room and WDW After Dark, where we talk more geekiness regarding pop culture and the world of Star Wars, Marvel, and Disney. So we do appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Don't forget to tuck your head. Nick Buckwinkle will be mentioned probably soon. Nick,
I almost mentioned in the episode, and what I was going to say was, so Nick Buckwinkle didn't do the same match every night, and that's the truth. His match was different. Nick Buckwinkle's match was different every night. Everybody that follows wrestling in that era knows that, and that's why he's better than Ric Flair. Now we have Scott Hudson, a WCW announcer, proving that Nick Buckwinkle was, in fact, much better than Ric Flair. Thank you.
Obdurate recalcitrance.
And if you think that Ric Flair knows about obdurate recalcitrance, it wouldn't take 100 million English teachers before he learned that.
Thank you so much for that. And don't forget to tuck your head. We'll see you all next week. Take care.
Thanks for checking out Pro Wrestling Cast. If you've got a question or comment, leave us a voicemail at 615-9339-PWC. That's 615-9339-792. Follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Cast and on Twitter at P Wrestling Cast, or email us at ProWrestlingCast@gmail.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
The opinions and ideas presented in these podcasts are those of Pro Wrestling Cast and are for entertainment purposes.
You're awesome. Thank you so much, Mr. Fuck, for saying what needed to be said.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are currently holding for further traffic clearance.
Check out Kristen's new website, magicaljourneysvacations.com, for all your vacation needs. Disney, Universal, cruise lines, and more.
Thank you for traveling with us.
magicaljourneysvacations.com.
Have her book your magical vacation today.
Crisis for the geek kind. Top geek officials admit they underestimated the hipster's defense capability. Join the geek revolution and save the galaxy. Geeks from all over the globe are joining up to fight for the future. They're doing their part. Are you? Want to know more? Join Weeby Geeks and the Geek Revolution and save the world. Service guarantees citizenship. Listen to Weeby Geeks podcast on iTunes and Stitcher or online at weebygeeks.net. Weeby Geeks, your voice for the geek revolution. Want to know more?